I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:59 p.m. on Friday, May 9th, 2025. Present today, we have Representatives Hannon, Bynum, Tomaszewski, Galvin, Jimmy, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Josephson, and myself, Co-Chair Schrage. Also here to help our committee today is Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Reed-Gardiner, Secretaries Bree Wiley and Leah Frazier, and our LIO moderator, Emily Mesh. Thank you for being with us to help us with our committee work. Before we start, please make sure that your cell phones are silenced. Today we will take up Senate Bill 57, the capital budget, Senate Bill 39 on payday loans, and any, and then that should complete our business today. Co-Chair Foster, actually, before I go to you, Representative Stapp has joined us at 2 p.m. Co-Chair Foster, can I get a motion?
Yes, Representative Schrage, I move House CS4CS for Senate Bill 57, Finance, Work Order 34-GS1460-R, dated May 5th, 2025, be reported out from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and authorization be given to the Legislative Finance Division and the Legislative Legal Services Department to make any necessary technical or conforming changes.
Okay, and I'll object for the purposes of discussion. I just want to briefly make a few comments and overview the work that this committee has done. The primary changes this committee has made revolve around funding to help address Alaska's deferred maintenance, including adding an additional $19 million for school major maintenance grants to fund the top nine projects on DEED's list, $1.35 million for Mount Edgecombe's top deferred maintenance project, $10 million for statewide deferred maintenance, $5 million for university deferred maintenance, $750,000 for the courts to address building maintenance. Further, we increased the grant amount to the Alaska Travel and Industry Association to promote Alaska's tourism industry by $2.5 million and added $53 million in receipt authority to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. In particular, I'd like to thank Representative Stapp for helping to bring this issue to light. For the fiscal year 26 items, this committee was able to add these projects while still achieving a $730,000 reduction in UGF, bringing the total to $161 million in unrestricted general funds, a roughly 45% reduction from what was proposed by the governor. I'll also note that there were no individual campus projects added into this capital budget. So we were fair to districts, to legislators in not providing special treatment, recognizing that we are in tough fiscal times. Lastly, the most recent committee substitute adopted by members, we incorporated fiscal year 25 capital budget items, as well as two fiscal notes for bills that had made it to the Finance Committee and had capital budget impact. With that, is there any committee discussion before I withdraw my objection? Not seeing any, I'm going to remove my objection. Is there any additional objection?
I'll object.
All right. Objection from Representative Johnson. Did you want to speak to your objection? Okay. Very good. Well, with that, I'd like to ask for the roll to be called.
Brief at ease.
Back on the record at 2:03 p.m. Representative Johnson, did you have any comments?
Yeah, I guess I will. I will be a no vote because we've included a fiscal note in advance of passing the Hillcorp loophole S-Corp tax. And so, as I mentioned before, for that reason, I'll be a no vote.
Thank you for those comments. And I will just mention on the record that inclusion of these fiscal notes does not constitute support or opposition for either bill. These were included in coordination with Ledge Finance and staff for these bills, given that they had made it to the Finance Committee. This is a contingency. Should those bills pass, their fiscal notes would be included in the budget. That said, I appreciate your comments. I understand you are maintaining your objection. Is that correct, Representative Johnson?
That's correct.
Okay, very good. Would the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Galvin.
Yes.
Representative Stapp.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Bynum.
No.
Representative Tomaszewski.
No.
Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Schrage.
Yes.
Six yea, four nay.
And on a vote of six yea, four nay, we have moved the Senate Bill 57 capital budget out of the Finance Committee. With that, we're going to take a brief at ease at 2:05 p.m. We're at ease.
Okay, House Finance back on record. We're calling the meeting back to order. It's 2:09 p.m. And we have one bill before us, and that is the Senate Bill 39, Loans Under $25,000, Payday Loans. I'd like to invite Senator Dunbar and his staff, Ms. Arielle Wiggin, to the table. And so this morning we had invited testimony, and it looks like they're still online. I think they are online. They haven't been online since this morning, but it looks like they've called in recently. If anyone has any questions for any of the three testifiers that spoke earlier, that was Trevor Storrs with the Alaska Children's Trust, Andrew Kushner with the Center for Responsible Lending, and the other person was Claire Lubke, Alaska Public Interest Research Group. Does anyone have questions for them, since that's where we left off? Representative Bynum?
I don't know if I have questions for them yet. I have questions, but I don't know who they're for yet.
Okay.
I'll wait.
Okay. So they are online if folks do have questions down the road. With that, we kind of took things out of order. And with that, Senator Dunbar, if you could introduce the bill and take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. I'm introducing today to you Senate Bill 39, a bill to cap payday loan annual percentage rates at 36%, aligning with the federal cap that already protects active duty service members and their families. This bill passed actually last year, this body, with broad bipartisan support, 37-2. In fact, every member who is still in this on this committee or in this body voted for this bill last year. So it is the same bill with two minor changes that we can discuss, sort of making it a little bit more targeted. So this bill, again, would bring payday lenders in line with Alaska's existing Small Loans Act, which applies to most other short-term loans. Despite the Service Members Civil Relief Act protecting against the targeting of active duty service members, a 2017 Texas study found that 45% of veterans had used a payday loan compared to 7% of the general population. These loans, often marketed as quick solutions, come with interest rates that average 421% in Alaska, according to the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, and frequently trap borrowers in cycles of debt. You see, the payday loan business model depends on repeat borrowing. Nationally, 75% of payday loan fees come from borrowers who take out 10 or more loans a year. In Alaska, the average borrower, as you heard this morning from Ms. Lubke, takes out 5.5 payday loans annually, often using one loan to pay off the last. These loans don't help build credit and often worsen financial instability. From 2017 to 2022, payday lenders garnished over $3.7 million from Alaskans' permanent fund dividends. Out-of-state online companies were among the most frequent plaintiffs in Alaska's small claim court during this time. And if public testimony in this body ends up being similar to the Senate, you'll hear a number of people call in from out-of-state. It's sort of an interesting thing that I think a lot of us don't realize. The vast majority of organizations engaged in this practice now are out-of-state online lenders. And despite their promises, payday loans often lead to more financial harm, including increased bankruptcy rates. And in fact, in your packet, there's a really interesting study that compares people who are very close to qualifying or not qualifying for a payday loan. That is, you know, 51-49, very close in terms of financial situation. And the folks that qualified for the loans, who in theory are in better financial health, actually went bankrupt at a much higher rate than those who didn't qualify for the loans. So SB 39 closes the loophole that allows payday lenders to operate outside Alaska's existing lending laws. It includes a non-evasion clause to ensure that out-of-state and online lenders are also held accountable. And this is not new or unusual policy. With this passage, Alaska would join 19 other states, including South Dakota, Nebraska, and Montana, in establishing a 36% APR cap. And as you heard from the testifier this morning, no state that has imposed the cap has gone backwards. They haven't decided to repeal this reform. And partly that's because the sky hasn't fallen in terms of, you know, this is a financial product that is used typically by people who are lower income. And so one of the counterarguments is, well, if you take away this financial product, they'll have nowhere to go. And that just hasn't been the case in other places. Traditional lenders have stepped up, community groups have stepped up, and in general, it's been a positive reform in the states that have adopted it. So with that, Mr. Chairman, my staffer can give a sectional if you'd like, or I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I don't know that I've actually asked my staff to maybe dispense with sectionals in the future unless they seem very, very pertinent. If the committee is interested in getting the sectional, I think we're okay, though. So
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And so with that, let's jump right into the fiscal note. Mr. Brody Anderson, if you could come up and walk us through the fiscal note.
Thank you. For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Before the subcommittee today is fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Appropriations, banking securities, allocation, banking and securities, OMB component 2808, control code PEHLA. This fiscal note reflects a zero operating cost in the FY26 appropriation, but it does reflect a change of revenue of a reduction of $19,500 of lost revenue. The fiscal note reflects that basically if the bill is enacted, there is licensures that begin at a biannual renewal. And if you take that for every 2 years, $39,000 would have been collected. Half of that per year would be a $19,500 loss of revenue. Ledge Finance did one step further analysis. Just they wanted to point out the fact that banking and securities provides approximately $18 million worth of revenue in net operating costs into the general fund. So, you know, they wanted that comparison to the $19,500 of lost revenue there. Mr. Chairman, that summarizes the fiscal note, OMB component 2808.
Great. Thank you very much. So with that, we'll go into questions, whether that be for the sponsor or regarding the fiscal note. And also just want to let folks know that we do have three people online available for questions. Director Rob Schmidt, Division of Banking, Tracy Reno, Chief of Examinations, Division of Banking, and Don Hanisch, Division Operations Manager for Division of Banking. So with that, first question, Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Firstly, thanks to you, Senator Dunbar, for putting this forward. This is a really important bill. And with regard to the analysis that was done by sharing what the banking and securities revenue is of $18 million, I'm not sure if there's anyone online to confirm this, but my sense is that by having this in place, that there would also be more of a neutralizer when it comes to a need or lack of need for housing vouchers, folks getting into bankruptcy and then landing in health care needs that the state will end up paying for. I can just see that $19,000 to me seems pretty irrelevant when you can consider, I think what you said was 47% of the users are veterans. And that many end up in bankruptcy. So anyway, I just wanted to comment, if I could, Co-Chair Foster, that and I don't think we have anyone online to confirm this, but it seems to me that this is actually, in the long run, a very short long run, I should say, this would be a not only cost neutral but likely advantageous. Thank you.
Nice. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Galvin, through the chair. I agree that I believe over the long term, folks that are being driven into bankruptcy by this practice will no longer require government assistance in some limited number of cases. But of course, our finance department doesn't sort of calculate those kind of future savings. Just a clarification, it was 45% of veterans in a Texas study. We don't have the Alaskan data. I will say that Ms. Lubke, who testified this morning from Alaska Public Interest Research Group, could probably speak a little bit more to the connection between government services and you know, the bankruptcies resulting from this. And the last thing I'll say, hopefully, to speaking to the public testimony on the Senate side, and maybe it'll be repeated here, I'm not sure, but we had a number of pastors call in. That was the single group that sort of called in most often, pastors supporting this bill because they saw the deleterious effects of payday loans within their congregations, and they saw their members of their congregation being harmed and going to bankruptcy and then turning to the congregation for help, and as, in addition to additional government services. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Representative Stout.
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Foster, several here. Thanks, Senator Dunbar, for being here in the House Finance Committee. First question I have is you mentioned something earlier, and it was regarding to active duty military members, and then you kind of rope-a-doped on a study on veterans. So explain to me, obviously there's a difference between a veteran and an active duty service member. Can you explain that to me? Well, not the difference. I know what the difference is, but the math, the percentage of loans through the chair.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Representative Stapp, through the chair. And yeah, I agree. It can be a little bit confusing because, as you know, sometimes folks use veteran and service member interchangeably. Of course, that's not the case. There is a federal law that says these kind of products cannot be marketed at active duty service members or their families. It has existed for a number of years. So it is, hopefully the number is zero, you know, the number of active duty folks that use these. We know that that law is occasionally broken, but it's very rare. But once you're a veteran, you are, again, part of the civilian population, and that federal law no longer applies. So that was where that percentage came from. It is veterans who have completed their service that are no longer protected by that federal law that have taken out these loans. And they take it out at a higher rate, according to the Texas study at least, in that population, at a higher rate than non-veterans. And so one way to look at this bill is we are extending the protections that currently exist for active duty service members that our federal government felt was appropriate because they knew it was getting our, particularly our young soldiers, airmen, and other service members into trouble. We are extending that protection to everyone in the state, not just active duty service members. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stout.
Yep, then Co-Chair Foster through the chair to Senator Dunbar. Packet's got several oppositional letters in. I'm just curious what you think. I'm sure you probably have rebuttals for the argument, so I'm just going to read off a couple to you. Basically, this group, I don't know who they are, the Southwest Public Policy Institute, their argument is if we were to pass this bill, you would cut off access to essential financial tools, particularly low-income, underbanked folks. And the argument, they say, is alternative lending sources like PALs, payday alternative loans, are largely unavailable to consumers. They are supposed to serve, and they say they tested 15 credit unions in New Mexico, and 86% of them denied membership. So I guess that would be the first question. How would you tackle that objection through the chair?
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Representative Stapp. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Stapp through the chair. That's right. So that's going to be the primary objection, and it has been every state that has passed this from the payday lenders themselves or organizations that they pay, like the one that you just described, or have some financial relationship with, where if these loans aren't available, then the folks that typically take them out won't have any other options. And I can say that, and I think the gentleman from the Center for Responsible Lending could speak more to this if you wanted to direct a question to him. But that just hasn't been the case in other states. That is, more traditional lenders do offer products. In fact, I think there's a letter of support from either an Alaskan Credit Union or Wells Fargo or both in the packet regarding this bill, because there are financial products available, there are other nonprofits doing things like the Debt Jubilee, which you heard from ACPIRG this morning. And then the final point is, again, the statistical evidence is the folks that end up using this end up, on average, to be in a worse financial position than had they not taken out the loan. So I think the evidence from other states that have done this is pretty clear. And ACPIRG has done a lot of research through their debt jubilee project and through their other kinds of survey data to sort of, I think, rebut that specific point. But I would say if we could hear from the gentleman from the Center of Responsible Lending, he could probably add a little bit more detail.
And can I follow
up? Representative Scott?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So, yeah, no, appreciate it. I'm just curious what they make of these arguments. So the other argument they make is they say in the state of Illinois, when similar legislation was enacted, the data confirmed the outcome that consumers reported increased difficulty in managing financial emergencies, and many have been pushed into higher credit cost alternatives that worsen their financial standing. I'm sure there's a good rebuttal, so I kind of want to hear it if we can go to the folks.
And that's Mr. Kushner?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Andrew Kushner, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, Andrew Kushner, Center for Responsible Lending. I think in general, I agree with everything that Senator Dunbar has said. I think the first thing I'll say is that with these products, it's undeniable that the harms outweigh the benefits. This is, really a product that only puts people further behind. And actually, to answer the alternatives question directly, in the last several years, a number of new products, since the pandemic, we're talking about post-2020, a whole number of new products really have come onto the market that are options for folks that are in need and that would be otherwise, turning to payday loans. I think many of the biggest banks, we're talking about mainstream banks, offer small dollar loan products. They're repaid in installments over a period of time rather than in a balloon payment, which is what you see with a payday loan, which just means you have to pay it all back in 2 weeks. There are new fintech products that can be helpful in this case, and actually the American Fintech Council has been supportive of this legislation. They're a trade group that represents more innovative lenders. And with respect to the Illinois situation, industry, there are industry-backed studies out there that payday lenders and other predatory lenders put out that cherry-pick data or that show, a certain story that they want to portray. But I think, at bottom for us, it goes back to the fact that, these laws, once they're passed, 36% interest rate caps, no state has ever gone back on that policy choice. And I think that is for good reason. And it's actually, making more and more sense as we go on, because there really are better alternatives than ever before in this area.
Okay, follow Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stowe.
Yeah, I guess, I'm no fan of payday loans. I don't, I'm not even fans of loans to subprime creditors, to be honest, because I think that they're setting people up for failure on a personal level. I'm just curious if you guys found any, let's say, easily rebuttable things when they cite their studies. Like I said, I don't know who these folks are. I'm just reading the things in the packet. But I'm going to say here, there's another argument that they make here. Curious what you guys would have that to say. They say that Alaskans have the highest average credit card balance, and they have the second highest credit card utilization rate in the country. And these people are basically saying that if we take this financial product away, which I'm not a fan of at all, that these folks will basically not be able to pay their stuff because they can't have money from loan sharks and stuff, through the chair.
Mr. Kushner?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, happy to address that as well. A credit card, so someone who is heavily indebted with credit cards or other types of pre-existing debt is really exactly the kind of person most at risk for being pushed into bankruptcy or having additional harms from payday loans. it in fact only really indicates how Alaska borrowers are especially vulnerable in this circumstance. And credit card debt, while a major problem in this country, undoubtedly, and I know something that many Alaskans struggle with, it accrues at an interest rate of 30%, 32%, something like that. With these loans, we're talking about 300% or even higher in Alaska. And the industry may say this is a short-term loan. Credit card loans are longer-term. But the reality is that with the repeat borrowing that we heard Senator Dunbar talk about, folks are in these loans once they get started down the pathway more or less consistently. So it really is accruing at a true, triple-digit interest rate over the year. It just doesn't make sense that for someone who's already struggling with a major debt load to put additional unaffordable debt on top of that really just compounds the harm.
Follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow-up.
So I'm going to shift gears here. Someone can answer this one, too. You have another oppositional letter from Hudson Cook regarding, again, I don't know who Hudson Cook is. I just think it's important to put who these folks are on the record. Section 10 of the bill, gentleman argues that Senate Bill 39 would impair highly regulated U.S. banks from making legal loans to Alaskans. I don't know what that means, and I don't get that by reading Section 10 of the bill. I'm just curious if someone can talk to the concerns from, it's Catherine Brennan, the partner at Hudson Cook LLP, and why she would say that through the chair.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I would direct that question either to Ms. Lubke from ACPIRG or to perhaps the person from Division of Banking Securities who's also online.
Let's check with Ms. Claire Lubke first. And if you don't have any comments, we can move over to Division of Banking.
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I'm looking at Section 10 of the bill now, and I guess I don't understand the question. Representative Stapp, could you clarify what the letter of opposition says about Section 10?
Follow Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
All right. Through the chair to, I'm going to actually read. I typically don't read things word for word, but I'm not a banker, so I figured that fire truck's a little annoying too, by the way.
Pre-fitties?
Yeah. I got it. Okay, so basically the individual here.
Pre-fitties. House Finance back in record, 2:32 p.m. Representative Stapp, if you could back up just a little bit.
Yeah, I think, Co-Chair Foster, just so the public knows, and then I'm going to go online here to the banking and securities. So I'm just reading through some of the objections to the bill in the packet. They have a stack of oppositional letters. And I don't know what the basis of this objection is. This is a letter we received, or the Senate Finance received, from Hudson Cook, from Catherine Brennan, who's a partner at Hudson Cook LLP. They have no idea who they are or what they do, but she writes in this letter in the second paragraph that the Small Loans Act provides an optional leasing scheme for the purpose of making loans in the amounts of $25,000 or less at a greater rate of interest discount, a consideration that the lender would be permitted by law to charge if the person were not a licensee. 3, the SLA exempts a person doing business under and permitted by law of Alaska or the United States related to banks, savings banks, trust companies, building and loan assumptions, or credit unions from its licensing requirements. However, an exempt entity must still comply with other provisions of the SLA if it chooses to contract for interest at a greater rate of interest than permitted under Alaska usury limit on loans of $25,000 or less. The SLA does not currently require entities that broker, purchase, or service consumer loans to obtain a license. In hearings thus far, Discussions around this anti-evasion language have been focused on stopping unrelegated potentially offshore entities from circumventing Alaska law and even federal law. There is likely no argument over that objective. However, the way it is written, Senate Bill 39 would highly impair highly regulated U.S. banks from making legal loans to Alaskans. Senate Bill 39 would incorporate an anti-evasion provision into the SLA that recharacterizes a bank's partner slash service provider as the true lender on the credit transaction. And the reason I read that word for word is because I don't really understand it, but that's why I was hoping someone could tell me through the chair.
Let's go to Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stapp through the chair. I think I understand both who is making the objection. I believe it's a law firm employed by one of the lenders or one of the associations, and sort of broadly what they are objecting to. I'll say I think it is not the case. I think they made the argument that this is a novel anti-evasion provision and thus somehow runs afoul of federal law, or federal law trumps it. But I don't believe that's the case. The language that we are using here is not novel. It has been used in other states or something very close to it has, without it being struck down. And so, we have the ability to have our own state law and state regulation. And again, 19 other states have already done something like this. And I believe at least some of them have this kind of anti-evasion language, again, because so many folks are online now. And so I think maybe I would point back to the gentleman from the Center for Responsible Lending, if he could clarify if anything of what I've just said is false, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kushner.
Thank you again, through the chair. I'll keep this brief. Yeah, that's exactly right. Senator Dunbar is exactly right. This provision just merely says that for certain online lenders that partner with a state bank, in certain circumstances, the online lender can become subject to Alaska law, which is a very sensible provision. Trying to get at this problem called rent-a-bank lending, where an online lender will, route a loan through a bank headquartered out of state to try to evade Alaska law. Several states, as I mentioned in my testimony this morning, several states have passed language that is identical or very similar to this without issue.
Fault, Mr. Kutcher.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, so just to be clear, and I'll try to be super succinct with this, that as far as your understanding is, there are no provisions in this bill that would hinder, quote, U.S. banks from making legal loans to Alaska.
Mr. Kushner, or is that for a second?
Through the chair, yes, thank you. No, and there's a very simple reason for that. And I'm interpreting U.S. banks to mean a national bank. So in our system, banks have to be chartered somewhere. You're either chartered with the federal government or with the state. And frankly, federally chartered banks, which I think is what the letter writer means when she talks about U.S. banks, are in many cases effectively immune from state regulation altogether. So there's nothing that you all can really do to regulate national banks, and that's by design through our sort of federalist system. So I don't quite understand the basis of that objection as applied to national banks. They can make loans however they want in Alaska, is what I'm saying, as a matter of federal law.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, that makes sense. And just for the record, Mr. Kutcher, just a quick follow-up, I guess.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, the only reason I'm going through these is just because I'm just curious. Like I said, there's a lot of oppositional letters in here that make a lot of claims. I don't know the validity of the claims, so I just figured it would be nice to get rebuttals to the claims on the record. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I guess I was wondering if you would tell me what brought this to your attention as far as, I mean, I know it was a bill that, was here last year, but I mean, why do you think people really need this? Because I look back when I was young and maybe didn't have any credit whatsoever. I mean, this is the kind of thing that someone like me that doesn't like to go somewhere and ask for help is going to use this at times, especially a small business person.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, through the chair. I'll say this is great. I don't get to speak on your floor, so I'll give my little speech right here.
Oh, not too long.
The person that brought this to my attention was actually Representative Stanley Wright. And I was an economics major, and so I was actually skeptical of this kind of reform a couple of years ago because for exactly the reason you just said. I thought, well, doesn't this fit like an important segment of the market? You know, what will those folks do? And I was convinced by him, by your body, the House, that passed the law, and by ACPIRG, who's done a lot of research on this, to eventually introduce a bill last session through Community and Regional Affairs, where I was the chair. But it died before it could get over the line in the Senate. So we sort of just ran out of time. But I thought it was a useful reform, and so we picked it back up this year. Again, I'll say ACPIRG has done a lot of research on this and about the financial harm to Alaskans. I have also taken out short-term loans, and maybe you have this. Well, not short-term loans, but smaller loans, you know, car loans and the like. But we do it through more traditional financial institutions, and that's what the vast majority of people do, and that's what the vast majority of people will continue to do. The good news is those institutions and some innovative organizations like Chime, for example, which we have some information about, are creating more products that are sort of targeted at these low-dollar loans, particularly people who have not so great credit or no credit. And so these kind of products do exist and they are expanding, but those are subject to that 36% interest cap. And that's sort of what I want to stress. We are not saying you can't make a loan less than $25,000 or to a person who doesn't have, you know, pristine credit. What we're saying is they should be protected at that 36% cap the way that almost every other kind of loan is and the way that American service members are explicitly protected by federal law. So again, we're not saying get rid of small loans. We're saying let's impose this 36% cap, which is also, by the way, a pretty, in my opinion at least, 36% is quite a high interest rate. And there is profit to be made there, and we know that traditional lenders are making profit there. So we don't want the market to completely go away. We just want the 36% to protect these folks.
Thank you. Follow up, I guess I didn't. I was trying to get the answer there. I'm not entirely certain who it's going to help. But I guess what I'm questioning then, how come this bill doesn't exclude pawn loans?
Senator Dunbar?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. What kind of loans?
Representative Johnson?
Pawn shops. Oh. Pawn shops have high, you know, they have, go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, through the chair. And I'm glad you gave this question because I wanted to point out the two small changes from the bill that you guys passed last year was and I say you guys, obviously there are new folks here too, but the previous legislature, the House passed. The two small changes are we added mutual savings banks to the list of sort of these exempt organizations. That was at the request of a mutual savings bank in Fairbanks because they weren't sort of explicitly called out, just to other kinds of banks. And then the pawn brokers. So pawn shops, they do sort of two different kinds of business. Some of them actually do engage in payday lending, and that will be banned, or not banned, but the 36% cap will be imposed. And then they have collateralized pawn shop loans, right? Pawn loans, what we more traditionally think of as the pawn business. That was already exempt in the past law. It just wasn't clear. So the amendment was just clarifying. The bill that you guys passed through this committee and was passed last year in the House also exempted pawn shops. It just wasn't clear, if that makes sense. And so we spoke with the pawn shops about it. It was never, I think, anyone's intent to get rid of that kind of business because those kind of pawn loans, crucially, are collateralized. So it's very different. It's a different kind of business than this payday loan.
Representative Johnson?
To follow up, I don't have any real desire to protect pawn loans because they actually have a higher fee than the payday loans, probably about 20% versus 15%. and they have to, you know, you have to have collateral. So I don't really see any rational reason to exempt pawn shops, but so other obviously they are used quite a bit because we have pawn shop on any corner that is a more of a lower income area. There's a lot of pawn shops. So actually a pawn shop costs more even though it's collateralized. So we're forcing people that don't have an option now of a payday loan, of forcing them to go collateralize something that's probably one of the most expensive things they own, and also is going to cost them more. So what's the rationale there?
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'll provide my sort of short answer, and then I think the gentleman from the Center for Responsible Lending could also speak a little bit more to this. You know, pawn shops, you're right, can be quite expensive. Although I feel because you have the item collateralized, there is sort of a cap to it, if that makes sense. There is an end point, whereas these loans can be redone over and over and over. That's really what drives the high expense, is you're not taking out one loan. You're taking out 5.5 loans on average to try to pay off the previous loans, and 10 in some cases in other parts of the country. And so the interest gets higher and higher and higher, and I think significantly more expensive than those traditional pawn products. The other thing I'll say is, you know, we have a lot of brick-and-mortar pawn shops in Alaska. They are Alaskan small businesses owned by Alaskans. And it is just no longer the case in payday lending that there are a lot of those kind of brick-and-mortar places. Most of it now happens online. So the degree to which we care about that, the money in the pawn shops mostly stays in Alaska. Now, again, perhaps people that are going to pawn shops, they could benefit from Representative Eichheid's financial literacy bill that y'all heard this morning. It's not always the greatest option, although it is the option for some folks, and sometimes people do use them. But we, you know, that is a broader reform, and I'll say that that would impact a lot of small businesses in Alaska. I think if the public testimony here goes like it did in the Senate, you'll hear mostly from out-of-state folks, because that is where the payday lending business now lives. And Mr. Chair, if perhaps the gentleman from the Center for Responsible Lending could speak a little bit more to the pawn shop issue.
Mr. Kushner?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster and Senator Dunbar. I'll add just two points briefly. The Alaska Small Loan Act has always excluded pawn shops, making pawn loans. As the senator said, many pawn shops also engage in non-collateralized, lending. And so this exemption, it really sort of clarifies something pre-existing that has always been a facet of Alaska lending law. So I wanted to just make that point. It's not that,
Mr. Kushner,
that they are getting carved out of this bill specifically. The second thing I'll say is that, I agree completely with the senator that the reason why we view pawn loans very differently is that the borrower's exposure is effectively capped, at the value of the item. And, they can be expensive. They're not a great product for most consumers. I agree with that completely. I think we'd like to see them capped at 36%, at least in my organization. But the way that they differ from payday loans is that you can't get into a situation with a pawn loan like you can with a payday loan, where you take out that initial $300 loan, and 6 months later you owe $3,500, which happens. I mean, it really does happen frequently as you just continue to borrow. I think that's why we view them differently.
Representative Johnson?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out where somebody's going to have an opportunity to go get some money if this is an opportunity, it isn't available to them, unless they go to a pawn shop, I guess, and hawk something of value that they have, when we're really collateralizing a future, like a future payday.
Okay.
I have some more questions, but I'll let it go for right now.
Okay. Got Representative Bynum, then Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I had some of the same questions dealing when we're talking about pawn brokers doing pawn loans. I get it that we're saying that that maybe it's not as big of a threat because there's some kind of a cap on that. You know, I can take my ring off here, go into the pawn shop, and they'll give me an evaluation and say, we'll give you $500 for your $1,000 ring, and you have 90 days to pay that, and we're going to charge you interest. But if I don't pay back that loan, then they're going to keep my item, so I'm out twice the value of that item. Or I can negotiate with them, and they're going to tell me to continue to pay those interest payments, renew those loans while they hold on to my item because they're just making money off of me for that item. So I'm not speaking – I mean, their business is their business. We're not here to talk about that, but it just seems to be something where we talk about I'm bringing an item of value in. I was reading in one of your items here, and it talked about, you know, that we're providing loans to people that don't have the necessary collateral to provide or certainty, and then that means that then you can't do that. But that also then means there's risk. So I was looking at this, and it was talking about the loan rates, and we had a $100 loan would be an example, and they say 36% APR. When you look at that loan, a $100 loan with a 36% APR for 2 days, the value of that to me, given that loan, is 20 cents. Okay, so for something that's unsecure, where somebody might need that $100, I don't even think I'd loan my friend Representative Stapp $100 for a couple days there without some kind of a deal there. But 20 cents, I don't know, probably not worth it. So we're talking about somebody trying to give that loan. And so that seems to me like a loan I would never give if I'm a business person because it's a high-risk loan. On the other hand, if I charged a $5 fee for the same $100 for a week, that's a 261% APR, even if I'm doing a flat fee on the loan. So I'm just a little trying to apply APR language to this type of loan structure for a loan that is not very secure or high-risk. Is obviously problematic, I think, for that instrument to still be available. So have you thought about or has there been any consideration of maybe looking at the existing structures and just limiting how they can do their fee structure to protect the business line that they have for a payday loan and then not put so much risk on the individual getting the loan?
Senator Dunbar?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Bynum through the chair. You know, I think your question is does sort of cut to the heart of the public policy question. And I think it dovetails pretty well with what Representative Stapp was asking as well. You'll probably hear testimony from folks about the fact that there are just these that there are already existing caps and there are just these flat fees and that kind of stuff. The challenge is again the repeat borrowers. That is how these things start to really rack up. I don't want to sort of kind of recapitulate what I said, but I think it's a public policy choice. The good news is that you're right, the profit margin is low and the risk would seem to be relatively high for lenders in this space. But there are lenders that are entering it. And some of them are fintech companies like Chime. Some of them are credit unions and traditional lenders. The experience in other states is not that this market just goes away. It's that you end up having sort of innovation in the space and finding ways to mitigate the risk to the lender, which certainly does exist, and that the folks that are taking advantage of these products now end up in a better place financially over the long run than they are now when they are subject to these, could be, 400% APR.
Sure. Thank you. Quick follow-up.
Representative Bynum?
I retract my comment that I would loan my friend from Fairbanks $100 if he needed it. But I was looking in the Military Lending Act, and that was in 2006 when that was done, put a 36% cap on military lending. And so effectively what that did for military members is that it meant that payday loans were not available to them. And There's lots of reasons why the military did that. I mean, obviously, many of us know as soldiers that you have a lot of responsibilities that are put on you when you talk about financial instruments that hold you far and above just being a civilian. For example, credit cards. If I have a credit card as a military member and I have a debt and I miss payments, you're likely going to find yourself in front of your CO trying to explain why you're not making your credit card payments and potentially have disciplinary action and potential discharge from service for mismanagement of your finances. So I think there's a level of responsibility in military that's there is why the military, and they made this law, because we're finding that soldiers were getting into these types of troubles and it was impacting readiness. But that obviously readiness doesn't apply to the general public. So there's still a lot to learn in the space of this particular bill and how it will impact this type of business and or not whether or not these businesses will even survive. I think there's definitely concerns about the online component of dealing with these payday loans through apps versus being able to go in and see somebody and give them a check and, you know, making that kind of in-person promise. I don't know how we can deal with that or if that's been explored through this process. But I would hate to have us go through this process and then push people to say they're going to go use the pawn component as the solution when they're giving tangible goods up that could be family heirlooms or other items to be able to meet this gap. So I guess there's a lot to learn, and I appreciate you being here to bring this in front of us. Thank you.
Any comments, Senator Dunbar?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I don't want to suggest that the only other alternative or where we want to push people is towards the pawn market. I was sort of just addressing why that exemption is in there. And again, it was just clarifying language because the law already exempts them from this kind of thing. And the law last year already exempted them from this kind of thing. Yeah, you're absolutely right about the additional responsibilities for people in uniform, partly because when you are highly indebted, you are more susceptible in many cases to being targeted by foreign adversaries or other sort of ne'er-do-wells, and then you can become a security threat because people get desperate. That is not the case for civilians, I hope, in most cases. So I don't want to draw a one-to-one parallel. I think you're right. Still, it is the case that I believe that law that the federal government put in place, I would think they would consider it a success. That is to say, it's generally a good thing that our service members haven't been participating with these kind of extremely high interest loans. And I think the 19 other states that include, I mean, both red states and blue states, Nebraska and South Dakota and Illinois, that their experience also has been generally positive with this kind of reform, and none of them have repealed it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll go to the next two questions, and then we'll call it a day. Next up, I've got Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you for being here, Senator Dunbar. Fortunately, I have never had to participate in a payday loan, as we're describing that, but Alaska state law describes it as a deferred deposit advance. But I guess for this discussion, I'll refer to it as the payday loan. So right now in Alaska law, it looks like we have a maximum allowable limit of $500 loan. Is that what you understand?
Ms. Wiggin?
That is our understanding, but I'd love to verify with DBS and also with Claire Glovke.
Okay. Mr. Robert Schmidt, can you put yourself on the record?
This is Robert Schmidt. I'm the director of the Division of Banking and Securities. Could the representative kindly repeat the question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Right now, Alaska law describes these as deferred deposit advance. I'm going to call them payday loans just for discussion purposes. But right now, Alaska law today limits the payday loans to a maximum of $500 and a duration of 14 days or 30 days, depending on a borrower's pay cycle. Is that accurate?
My understanding is that, if I may, through the chair, my understanding is that payday loans on a 14-day cycle, but maybe extended. On the particular mechanics of payday loans, I would defer to my chief of examinations, Tracy Reno.
Ms. Reno, if you could put yourself on the record.
Through the chair, this is Tracy Reno, chief of examinations with the Division of Banking Securities. Representative Tomaszewski, that is correct that it's 14 days. They may be extended and then rolled, as Senator Dunbar has mentioned, but it is $500 max for 14 days, and then there's possibility of extension after that.
So follow up. So, yes, thank you. Thank you for that. There are an additional, it can be rolled over two consecutive times, and I just want to go through so that they don't, Alaska law currently does not allow, it's not an interest rate that we have put on these payday loans. It is, in fact, a flat fee and also an origination fee. So we have an origination fee of $5. So you go to the payday loan, you get $500, you have a $5 origination fee, and then you pay a 15% flat fee. So basically what I'm looking at, just going through the numbers, after 30 days, if my pay period is, if I get paid monthly, then I can roll this for 30 days apparently. What I'm looking at is about a 16% interest rate, if you just go by APR. And then you can do two consecutive times where you can roll it over. So my question is, when a borrower defaults, and what recourse does the lender have when they come back to what damages or fees can they charge to a borrower who defaults on their payments?
Through the chair, this is Tracy Reno again. They need to notify their lender if they're unable to make their payments. And each loan agreement has its own information in there, but basically Alaska law allows the borrower to renew his loan twice. The renewal is not automatic. The borrower has to request it prior to the due date of the loan. And then if the borrower knows they're unable to make the loan payment, then they can renew the loan. And then at some point, there is a payment arrangement that is allowed before the loan due date. Again, they have to let them know and have this conversation and create a new contract. But basically, there's a workout of a payment agreement, and they can offer a payment plan. It's part of the statute for payday lending, but they offer a payment plan and set that up for them so that it doesn't keep accruing interest after that point.
So So it doesn't actually accrue interest. It's just the flat fee that they charge, and then the rollover fee would be another flat fee for any time they roll over up to two consecutive times. So, but what I'm getting at is Alaska state law today, the lender may only recover a maximum of $700 over the amount owed, and they can work out in the event that a borrower cannot pay the advance back in full, they can pay their outstanding loan in equal installments over a 6-month period without any additional fees or interest. Is that correct?
The chair, Tracy Reno, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. And so I guess back to, if I can follow up with the
Representative Tomaszewski.
So I'm just curious as to this. When we go to a 36% APR, you're basically saying, we're basically saying that $500 loan over 1 month is going to incur about a $15 charge or fee for the lender. So if these payday loan gives out $500. At the end of that month, they'll owe $15 on the 36% APR. And to me, I think that will definitely close the door for any borrower. So I guess if the intent of this legislation is to kind of shut these types of loans down completely. I guess that would probably definitely do it, because I couldn't, in good conscience or in good money management, loan $500 and then for only $15 at the end of the month, especially when you look at the fact that many of these people are not, or many, I don't know how many, may default or may not pay you that $500 back at all. So it seems like a good idea, but I guess if the intent of this legislation is to shut these down, I think you may do it. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Jimmy?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. My question is pertaining to the permanent fund dividend. So does the payday lenders in Alaska, would they garnish the PFD?
Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Representative Jimmy, through the chair. Yes. In fact, I think I have the number. The payday lenders garnished from 2017 to 2022 in a five-year period, they garnished $3.7 million from Alaskan's PFD.
Follow up?
Follow up.
So that would make it a guaranteed loan?
Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Jimmy, through the chair. You've hit on a really important point here, Representative Jimmy, which is, I believe, you know, we're a small market, so why did all of these out-of-state lenders, why do they have so much interest in Alaska? You know, why has this bill sort of drummed up so much out-of-state opposition? I think we are a uniquely profitable place to do this kind of business because of the PFD. Now, you don't get the same benefits of a guaranteed loan in terms of the interest rate they're going to give you, but they know they can come and garnish our PFD in a way they can't any other state in the whole country. I suspect that is why we may have gotten so much outside one of the reasons we've gotten so much outside opposition is because of the PFD. Thank you.
May I ask another question?
Representative Jimmy.
Thank you. So people do go out and get these loans, and they usually have something like an emergency, or they need to get a loan for a part for their vehicle or their snow machine or whatever transportation they use. And somebody in that position may not have the resources to research or to think to research what they are applying for through using and understand what the APR is. So they might be signing up for something they do not understand. When someone gets a payday loan, what is done to make sure that they do understand and the maximum cost that it would cost for them?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jimmy, through the chair. I think what you said is absolutely true. A lot of folks don't understand the sort of deep waters that they are swimming into when they take out these kind of loans. But if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, I'd love to hear from Ms. Lubke more about ACPIRG has done research on this, and it goes also to Representative Tomaszewski's question about, you know, look, in the law it says that there are these caps and you can only do it twice and what have you. But the actual lived experience, the actual survey data says it's not two loans, it's 5.5 loans. And I don't know the exact mechanism with which they get around the regulations and statute we currently have, but I'm not implying they're doing anything illegal. I'm just saying they found a way to do it. And the actual ultimate payment that the folks give ends up being a lot higher than they think. And so if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, I'd love if Ms. Lubke could speak a little bit more to Representative Jimmy's question.
Ms. Claire Lubke.
Hi, for the record, this is Claire, Economic Justice Lead at Alaska Public Interest Research Group, through the co-chair Foster to Representative Jimmy. Thank you for that question. The Deferred Deposit Advance Licensee Statute does require a disclosure before they make a loan to a customer, and you can find that in 0650510. I wanted to confirm what Senator Dunbar was saying, that if people understood the cost of the loan they were getting into, we believe they wouldn't be taking out over 5 consecutive loans a year. I would like to speak to some of Representative Tomaszewski's comments, if I may, Co-Chair Foster.
Representative Ms. Lubke. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. I would like to point out that the deferred deposit advance licensee statute only puts a minimum loan term in statute of 14 days and does not put a maximum loan term. So some of these payday loans are being offered with longer loan terms. I'd also like to mention that there is in statute a requirement to offer a payment plan, but as Ms. Reno indicated, there's a pretty extensive communication threshold in order to actually get the information you need about those payment plans. And we don't have the data that says what the uptake is, if customers are actually being offered those plans, if they understand that they have a right to those plans. And again, if there was uptake of a payment plan, I don't think that borrowers would be taking on one loan and then another loan and then another loan. So we have a situation where people are taking out a payday loan. It doesn't require any kind of credit check or, you know, requirements, no indication of someone's wages to get a payday loan. So they can take out one loan, an originating loan, and then, you know, a bit later, you know, whether it's a two-week term or a month term, later they can take out a new loan to pay off an originating loan. And that creates a cycle where you actually are, you know, accruing interest over these long periods of time. And I finally would like to mention that the section on fees, the deferred deposit license requirements for fees were mentioned. If fees were the only charges associated with these loans, then that would be a 15% interest rate. And if that were the case, that was the only thing being charged to borrow this money, then they would be in compliance with the Alaska Small Loan Act, which requires a maximum of 36% APR. So annual percentage rate includes both interest rate and fees. And interest rate is not included in the deferred deposit advance loan. So thank you for allowing me to make those comments.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I'm going to try to give a little help here, I think, to simplify. So first I want to say what I think you are saying is somebody goes and takes out a payday loan. They can't pay it back in 14 days, so they take out another payday loan to pay out the payday loan, and then they can take out another payday loan to take out the other payday loan, and they can basically refinance those terms three times. So you end up having a person who basically gets hit with these fees six times because they never could pay out their first payday loan. Is that correct, through the chair?
Is that for Senator Dunbar?
I think that is for Ms. Lubke, Mr.
Ms. Lubke,
chair.
Okay.
Thank you. For the record, Claire Lipke from Alaska Public Interest Research Group. Through Co-Chair Foster to Representative Stapp, yes, there. That is primarily what I'm saying. There are some, I want to emphasize again that the maximum fees are established in statute, but the maximum interest rate is not. So the fees are not the only charges associated with these loans. But I think you got the idea in communicating that there is a continuance function on the originating loan that maxes out at two continuances. But then you can also just take out a new loan, and that results in moving beyond those continuance maximums.
Yeah, Paul, Mr. Coacher. Yeah, thanks. I think I like the way I said it better, but I appreciate it. So help me walk through. So I'll give a very clear example here. Okay, so like, okay, I'm about to be evicted from my apartment. My payday is 2 weeks from now. And I need money to pay my rent. So I go out and get a payday loan. So I pass this bill, can't go get that payday loan. What options do I have available right now so I don't get evicted? How do I get money through the chair? To anyone who can answer.
Senator Dunbar.
Co-Chair Foster.
Ms. Lubke. Oh. Go ahead, Ms. Lubke.
Pardon me. Thank you. through Representative Stapp, through Co-Chair Foster, I'd like to mention this company called Chime again. They just provided that example. They recently, it's an online company, we've thrown around this term, a financial tech company. They're creating, they have the scale to offer these loans to high-risk borrowers that, quite frankly, like wasn't available in even 2006 when the Military Lending Act was passed. And as Mr. Kushner from the Center for Responsible Lending mentioned, also there's been a ton of innovation in this space even in the last 5 years. But there's a company called Chime. You can access them through an app. They've recently started offering a loan, a $100 loan, up to $500 for a flat $5 fee. They allow installment payments of minimum of $35. And if you do all the complicated math to calculate the interest rate and the fees, they are coming in at a 30% annual percentage rate. So somebody who can't make their rent can go online and access this financial product, and it is better than what is being offered by these more predatory lenders online.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
So, yeah, trust meat and potatoes is the question here. All right, so here you say there's another person. So if right now, if I were to go check these folks out, I could get money to pay my rent. That's what you're saying. What if I don't have – if I can't do it online? Okay, right now I can walk in a building – and I can get the money to pay my rent. I personally am not a fan of payday loans. What I'm trying to figure out here is if we pass the bill, people aren't just now not able to fund things and I have problems. So help me out. Help me understand this through the chair.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Stapp through the chair. So my staff did do some research on this, and there appears to be a product at Global Credit Union, which I believe used to be Denali Credit Union. I'm thinking New Vision. I'm sorry. They've a lot of them have changed their names. So Global Credit Union does offer a product. Wells Fargo also offers a product that is a small loan product as well. And it looks like the Global Credit Union is 7 to 15% APR. Wells Fargo is 20 to 25% APR. So there are these small dollar products available that would fit within the 36% cap.
Fault, Mr. Kutcher.
Representative Stout.
Yeah, thanks. All right. So what do I do to get them, right? So here's my thing, right? There's an old saying with banks, they don't loan poor people money because they can't get paid back, right? So usually, you go to a bank, you got to provide a bunch of financial information to get a loan. You got to have collateral, stuff like that. The reason these payday loan things are popular with people, even though they're terrible ideas, is because you just got to show, you got a paycheck that people know that you're going to get money that they can take away from you, and or they can garnish your PFD or something. So, like, in order for me to get the Wells Fargo loan or the Alaska USA loan, what do I got to show them to get the money? Because remember, I get evicted in my scenario here in 48 hours through the chair.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll use the example of Global Credit Union. So they say they can process your loan decision in 24 hours. To get the loan, you provide them your name, your Social Security number, your physical address, your employment information, your gross monthly income, and your date of birth. So not super different than what you would expect from a payday lender who, as you point out, is asking you for your future paycheck.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
So let's focus on my gross income because this is usually where banks tell people no. Again, example, I'm poor, I need money, I can't pay my rent. Bank looks at my statement and goes, dude, no. So if I go to the bank, let's say, and I need to take out this loan, are they looking at my prime status? Like how big a factor is my gross income? Like, because again, the payday loan people generally they don't care because you got the pay stub and they know they're going to take it out of the pay stub.
Senator
next
Dunbar.
Paycheck, excuse me.
Thank you, Rep. Chair Foster. I think we're reaching the limits of my ability to answer off the cuff from these papers. So I would prefer if we could take this offline, Representative Stapp, and perhaps we could provide you something in writing.
Thank you. Okay. In line, I've got Representative Bynum, Josephson, Hannon, and Galvin. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I've been hearing a lot of the conversation here, and it's been really great conversation, learning a lot. Appreciate that. But I think that I feel like there's been some confusing messaging been sent around, and I just want to make sure that I'm clear. My understanding is that I can go get this loan. I can go get this loan. There's a in the statute it tells me that that person giving me the loan can charge me $5 for the fee to get the loan, and then they charge me a 15% fee for the amount of the loan, $100 to $500. So on a $500 loan, they can charge me $75 to get that loan plus the $5. It's an $80 fee. And I have to have it for at least 14 days, and I can have it longer. The term can go longer. But when it comes time to repay that loan, if I don't have the money to repay that loan, I have two options. I can roll the loan over twice. I can do that two times in a row, and each time they do that, they can charge me the fee. Or I can say, as an option, I want to go on to the payment plan. Now, I don't know if they had charge a fee for that. But when we talked about the two times, my understanding is that the two times is the times that I can roll the same loan. So it's obviously less expensive for me to roll the loan than to go get a new loan to pay that loan because I don't have to pay the origination fee. And so I just want to make sure, and I don't believe there's any limit to the number of these things that I can get in any year. I don't see that in the statute. It says I can go get 15 of them a year if I want. I can only have one. That one loan I can roll twice. That's it. I just want to make sure I'm understanding clear because I heard limits of 5 times, 10 times, 2 times, and I'm just making sure that my understanding of what I'm reading in statute and what I've been hearing in some of the looking at in some of the documents, if that's the accurate description of what we're talking about.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bynum, through the chair. My understanding, and I believe this is what Ms. Lubke said, is that you can only roll over the same loan twice, but there's nothing in our statute that prevents you from taking out a whole new loan and paying off that original loan. Whether that's financially wise or not, it's probably not, but that is the lived experience of a lot of folks in this space. And so I wouldn't call it a loophole. That's just something that that's just the fact of the law, that you can take out a new loan and do this.
And then I have one final clarification. So I'd heard the permanent fund dividend being used I'd heard the permanent fund dividend being mentioned here. Is there any mechanism that we're aware of where these lenders are using whether or not you're getting a dividend or not as a portion for getting this loan? Or is that just a byproduct that many Alaskans are getting the dividend and that when you default on a loan and they go to come after you, they're going to garnish your paycheck? Because my assumption is they're giving you this because I'm saying I have a job, not because you don't have a job, that you're just waiting for your next payday. That's the premise. Is the dividend or the ability to get a dividend a consideration for even being able to get these loans, or does that just happen to be a byproduct of that many Alaskans happen to get it and is something that would be garnished if you don't pay?
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bynum, through the chair. That's a really interesting question. I don't think we have data unless ACPIRG has done that research, and I think we'll get it to you afterwards if they have. I don't think they ask the question, are you eligible for a PFD or not? And we know a lot of folks aren't for a variety of reasons. I think, as you indicate, it is sort of just a feature of our market that a lot of folks do have PFDs that can be garnished, and many of them are. As I said here, these out-of-state online companies are among the most frequent plaintiffs in Alaska Small Claims Court.
Thank you.
Okay. On the list I've got Representative Josephson, Hannon, and Galvin. I need to step out. I would ask if Representative Josephson is able to close this out. And so I'll pass the gavel off. I did want to announce that our next scheduled meeting is Monday, May 12th at 9 a.m., we were to hear Senate Bill 64, which is the elections bill. It does not look like that is going to make it to us. I think it's still in the works on the other side, to my knowledge. And so if that is the case, then we will send an email out just notifying the committee what other bills we might take up at that 9 a.m. Meeting. So I think we'll still have the meeting. We just may have different content. So with that, I think we just need adjournment after the questions are asked. And so, Representative Josephson, thank you.
Well, it was thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The Senator Dunbar, this morning on the floor, I'm reminded that on the Capitol side, your body had fully funded, I believe, at least one of the two AHFC grants, which are designed to prevent homelessness, the SNUG, I think it's called, and the HAP. The HAP is the Homelessness Assistance Program. And I just thought of those because they're literally designed, I think, for the kind of hypothetical that Representative Staff spoke to. And I don't know if you want to add anything to those remedies as well.
No, thank you very much for the question, Mr. Co-Chair. And yeah, when I was responding to Representative Staff, I was trying to sort of cabin my remarks to just the private sector. But you're right. There are programs offered by the state and also nonprofits to try to alleviate just this. United Way, for example, in Anchorage, using in some cases municipal funds, has a rental assistance program as well. The funding there flexes. But you're right. There are government programs to try to alleviate some of these short-term challenges, particularly around homelessness. Thank you for bringing that up.
Okay, next question is from Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Senator Dunbar, I get and I'm on board with, I guess the legal name is deferred deposit advance loans, what we've colloquially called payday loans, and they're capped at $500. I have no problem us placing, I think it's a responsible thing to place a upper limit on the interest. Much of the bill, though, deals with a separate section of loans, these $25,000 loans. And so I am looking for some additional information about that. You know, it starts in Section 4, and, of course, the opposition to your bill has come and said there's a whole category of small businesses that these loans up to $25,000 and they're not payday loans. They use the term, this is an unintended consequence of the bill. It's not been talked about. It was in the bill last year, but we really didn't. So I need to understand how the bill impacts those loans. And if all it's doing is saying they too are subject to a 36% cap. And what they kind of percentages are they currently subjecting to their what kind of interest do they currently charge? And if it's 40% and it's 36, then I don't see them going away. But I don't know if they typically charge the kind of interest that the payday loans do.
Thank you. Representative Hannon, through the chair. I believe the $25,000 limit is what exists currently in the Small Loan Act. And so, again, the vast majority, in fact, almost all of those kind of loans are already subject to this 36% cap. There's a carve-out for these other kinds of loans. And what we are essentially doing is not imposing a cap, but rather removing an exception, if that makes sense, that effectively opposes the cap. Now, I think that there's specific anti-evasion language that it might be what you are flagging. And if I could defer to the gentleman from the Center for Responsible Lending, he could probably explain why that language is in there, as it is in other states where we brought this language from.
Mr. Kushner, are you still with us, and did you hear Representative Hannon's question?
I did. Thank you. For the record, Andrew Kushner, Center for Responsible Lending. I did, and through the chair, I'll say a couple of things. Yeah, so with respect to the longer-term installment loans, the bill actually does two things. Number one, it actually simplifies and in some cases raises the interest rate limit for some of these loans. So your Small Loan Act covers loans up to $25,000, and it has a tiered interest rate system, which basically means that, for smaller dollar loans, like I'm sorry, I don't have the language in front of me, but, let's say a loan under $2,500, the interest rate, might be 36%, but then as it goes up, so a loan for $5,000, right, might be at 31%, and a loan of, you know, $10,000 might be 30% or something like that. So what the bill does for these higher dollar loans is it gets rid of the tiered system and has a flat 36% across the board for all loans under $25,000. That provision has not been controversial. What has been controversial is the provision around anti-evasion, and that really gets at an issue of there's a small subset of online lenders who try to take advantage of the fact that most state interest rate limits do not apply to banks headquartered in other states. So that's the status. And these online lenders try to take advantage of that fact to make loans to, to Alaska residents or residents of many states at interest rates that vastly, in some cases, vastly exceed the limits. So, you know, we're talking about 160% APR on a $5,000 loan. So, like, you know, extremely expensive. And so what Section 4 of the bill says is, if the online lender routes the loan through a bank headquartered out of state, and by route, I mean, you know, the loan is issued by the bank in Utah, let's say. It has the Utah bank's name on the loan document, but the whole lending program, the underwriting criteria, et cetera, is controlled by the online lender in these cases. In many cases, the online lender buys the loan immediately after it's issued. So in circumstances like that, what Section 4 of the bill says is that the online lender is not actually a service provider of the bank, but in fact a lender under Alaska law. And what that means is that the loan has to comply with your interest rate caps. And that's just, I think a common sense way to get at the problem of out-of-state lenders trying to evade your state law. And again, it has been done in several other states previously.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I'm interested in hearing from Mr. Schmidt of our Banking and Securities on my same question.
Mr. Schmidt, Director, can you give your impression of an answer on this topic?
This is Robert Schmidt, Director of the Division of Banking and Securities, through the chair. First of all, a commentary on the Small Loan Act, in general. A current Alaska law has the Small Loan Act, which applies for loans that are $25,000 and under, and then another subset for the payday loans that are $500 and under. The Small Loan Act, much of it dates back to 1955. A great deal of the law is a territorial law. When this bill was originally proposed last year, it intended to eliminate payday loans and have everything be covered under the Small Loan Act, which is loans $25,000 and under. We asked the then sponsor of that bill to make modernizations to the Small Loan Act. To speak colloquially, the Small Loan Act is one of the last program areas where people send us their applications written on clay tablets. We added a lot of language to utilize the nationwide multi-state licensing system and to otherwise update the law and make it easier both for the regulator and the regulated to do business in Alaska and to not have so many of the provisions of this law be so antiquated. With that, did you want me to speak? Did you want an answer further to the anti-evasion provisions, or what specific provisions of the law would you like to have addressed?
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph. And Mr. Schmidt, your answer perfectly gives me clarity about my understanding, so I don't need further on the Evasion Act, but the importance that the reason it's included is to modernize our antiquated statutes dealing with the Small Loan Act. So thank you.
All right. I don't see any other questions. What I see on the calendar for the 12th of May is, first of all, we're going to hold this bill and undoubtedly take it up next week. On the calendar, we see SB 64, an elections bill, but that's not in our possession. There could be a previously heard bill like this one on Monday. So take follow your instructions from Helen Phillips. And then in the afternoon on Monday, we have Senate Bill 95 on child care assistance and a second bill on child care tax credits in the afternoon. So with that, we're going to adjourn this meeting at 3:34. Thank you.